Hi, I'm Frances Anderton and this is DNA. On today's programme, what does it mean to be condemned to be modern?
The exhibition is not a traditional architecture show, but they're contemporary artist projects who are responding to what we've been calling kind of the afterlives of modernist projects.
They're about a show in which Cuban, Brazilian and Mexican artists examine the rhetoric and the legacy of modernism in their countries. But we're going to open with a look at a project with high ideals for a site high in the Santa Monica Mountains, west of the 405. Here is Nicholas Begruen.
So we were lucky to be able to find a superb site above the Getty Center. It's a pristine piece of land, somewhat more than 400 acres. And the beauty of it is that it has extraordinary views, but it's extraordinarily peaceful, even though it's in the middle of the city. So we are in the city, but outside of the city, all at the same time. And it has already two ridges, which have already been flattened. So we're going to, on the first ridge, create what we think is almost a mile-long garden. And at the end, there will be the Institute, which will be a place to receive scholars who can not only work there and convene, but also live there. So it'll really be a place of work, but also of reflection.
Nicholas Begruen is the billionaire philanthropist who's planning to build a campus for his Begruen Institute. Which is what exactly? In a moment, you'll hear more about the Institute's purpose, the other campus Nick Begruen is building in MacArthur Park, and how he will win over skeptics of his plans. First, let's hear about this mountaintop building, which Begruen has likened to a secular monastery. It's on a flattened former landfill site whose previous owners got it entitled for the construction of 29 homes. The campus is being designed by the famed Swiss architecture firm of Herzog and de Meuron. The renderings of the campus show three main components: an almost 100,000 square foot institute, that's a one-story long low building that's lifted off the ground and made of raw concrete frame and roughened wood. Protruding above this are two large spheres. Then there's a 28,000 square foot scholars village of sunken adobe style buildings.
I think it's really quite stunning, and I think it also reflects the sensibility and the possibilities that not only the site offers, but also that LA historically and forward-looking offers. The main building is horizontal. LA is a horizontal city in terms of the architecture, but it looks out over the horizon, which is often the case in Los Angeles when you're in the hills. But it has these two spheres which not only anchor what really is a frame, this horizontal one-story frame. Not only do these spheres anchor the building, but it also lets you dream a little bit.
That was Nicholas Begruen. Herzog and de Meuron are based in Basel, Switzerland. They designed the Beijing Olympic Stadium known as the Bird's Nest, the Tate Modern in London and the de Young Museum in San Francisco. Now they're working on a proposed mixed-use mid- and high-rise building at 6th and Alameda in downtown LA. To the extent you can recognise a Herzog & de Meuron building, you'll find they savour materials, texture and tailoring solutions to their site. The Begruen campus design feels clear and elemental with its unadorned materials and platonic spheres, one of which will serve as a water tank. Here's the architect Jacques Herzog. We reached him by phone.
I think what we very strongly believe in architecture, Herzog & de Meuron, that architecture has to kind of display its very archaic qualities, which we miss so much in our daily lives. And the spheres are actually never been used in architecture, almost never, but they have been fascinating for architects since many centuries. And we all know these utopian architectures of the 18th century French, the Age of Enlightenment, where the sphere had a very clear position, intellectual position, up to Bachmann's Fuller, where the sphere was seen as, in his interpretation, as an amazing technical achievement. So we very much like this double function, that the sphere is at the same time something banal and ordinary, like pop art or pop architecture and something so spiritual.
Now, for architecture enthusiasts, this project sounds pretty fabulous, but will it get built? On reviewing the design, LA Times architecture critic Christopher Hawthorne wrote, "Is Los Angeles still the sort of city that pursues hugely ambitious cultural and architectural projects? Or is it a city that's running out of room and chastened by increasingly aggressive opposition to new development?" Well, there's already pushback against Berggruen's project. It's coming from homeowner associations in Mandeville Canyon and Mountain Gate, which is a neighborhood of gated communities with two golf courses. The Upper Mandeville Canyon Association has expressed concerns that the site emits methane gas. Also, that it is a wildlife corridor whose native animals and vegetation will be disrupted by construction and the campus operations from light pollution to traffic and human activity. They're also worried about unstable slopes being bulldozed, and they say fire danger is paramount. Nick Berggruen had this to say, starting with the traffic.
There is already a road which has been built a long time ago, which will restore, which exists, that goes up from Sepulveda. So but we won't even go through our neighbor, which is the Mountain Gate community. That's number one. Number two, because this facility is really mostly a research center, it's going to be very little in terms of people coming there. It's not going to be, we've been thinking about it, in some ways be nice to open to the public, because that, I think, is generally a positive thing. But then we thought about the impact ecologically and also in terms of the neighborhood and felt that we shouldn't do it. So it's really a research facility, so therefore not open to the public, which means that there will be virtually no traffic.
Berggruen also says they plan to manage methane emissions, perhaps even using them to generate energy for the site. He says he'll improve fire roads, increase the fire buffer, install irrigation that can help the LAFD, and make available a helipad and water from the spherical tank in the event of fire. As for the wildlife corridor and trails, he and the design team aim to restore and enhance them. Back to Jacques Herzog.
I think there's no project in Los Angeles that can compare in how carefully we treat nature, how much we respect it to build on places where already something has been before, or let's say where refilled land will be used and leave the rest intact, that 90% of the total land will be totally left as it is, very natural, that we respect the trails. We will eventually add trails for people so that there will not be mass tourism or masses of tourists or other people or guests come up and make a lot of noise. We will not have bus traffic and all of that. We really thought about so much, because this is really dear to our heart and all our intentions, this kind of very careful ecological treatment. We will try to become a model for how to treat landscape, how to use existing energy and make it sustainable. The project in itself will be much more sustainable than Mountain Gate and other comparable neighborhoods. I think it's amazing that some private person spent so much money to actually protect and sustain a landscape, a given landscape, which looks totally natural, but in fact has been artificially changed with all these refills. And the project is now an opportunity to bring back a lot of the original beauty.
That's Jacques Herzog of the architecture firm Herzog & de Meuron. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Nicholas Berggruen is the son of the late Heinz Berggruen, an art dealer, and his brother of art critic Olivier Berggruen. He's chairman of Berggruen Holdings. That's an investment company that focuses on real estate, private equity and alternative energy. And he established an institute devoted to governance in 2010. Eventually, he'll build a home on the mountaintop next to the campus. For now, he lives high in a tower in West Hollywood, from which you can look east to the Griffith Observatory and on a clear day west to his site in the Santa Monica Mountains.
Well, Berggruen Institute is now my oldest child in terms of one that I really pay attention to. So Berggruen Institute in terms of my professional life is really where I spend my time. So it's very important to me, but I think and I hope that it's a true contribution to the world of ideas in general. And the premise is simple. If we can focus on ideas that are key ideas, foundational ideas, both political and cultural, then we can hopefully improve people's lives. And when we look at politics, we look at politics in the very long term, in a very broad sense, politics as a system, as opposed to, you know, day-to-day politics. So we look at democracy as a system. Does it work? Can it be improved? Should it be changed? That's one. And two, we look at the cultures that are behind the lives we lead. And we think that culture is actually the biggest determinant in terms of our lives and our politics.
In terms of governance, are you looking at the philosophy of political systems, or are you looking to have an advocacy role? Are you looking to effect change?
First, the philosophy. And in some cases, where we think we can be useful, change.
There are other think tanks, political think tanks in Los Angeles, RAND, Reason. Reason takes a very specific position. It's libertarian. RAND was certainly somewhat conservative when it started. But as I understand it, you don't see yourselves as representing a particular political position or a set of interests or a set of business interests.
So we think the value of what we do is really the idea. So we don't want to start with a point of view. We want to maybe get to a point of view, but not start with a point of view. So we're on purpose, not partisan. We're very independent. Our funding is internal, so we don't need to cater to, you know, the interests of, you know, funders. So we're not an instrument of anyone. At the end of the day, we're interested in the ideas, and there may be ideas from the left or ideas from the right. As long as the ideas are interesting and valuable, we'll take them, and we may mix them.
Who will your scholars be?
When I say scholars, it's beyond scholars. In some cases, they may not be academics. So they may be thinkers, they may be ex-politicians, they may be philosophers, they may even be artists. People who care about the subjects that we're interested in and want to contribute. And they will have a period of time there where they can do their work alone or in groups. And we will also obviously host workshops.
So let's move now to the center of town where you're retrofitting an existing block.
So we've made an investment in MacArthur Park. If you know MacArthur Park is, I think, one of the most beautiful areas in all of Los Angeles. The park is stunning. There's a lake. It's sort of, LA doesn't have a center, but I would say it's one of the beating hearts of Los Angeles historically. It's been an area that's been challenged, and that's one of the reasons why we are going there, because we want to, you know, make an investment in the future of LA and to restore, in this case, a 1920s building. That's a very beautiful building, to make it sort of sing again. So there we can also have institute staff, we can have scholars, we can also have meetings and events, and it'll be a much easier place to interact really with the city. And it's part of our commitment, frankly, to Los Angeles, where the Institute is based.
And for that project, you brought in a very interesting Spanish firm called Selgascano. Why did you pick that firm?
Well, they are very exciting, very creative, and they have the ability, which not every architect has, of creating very dynamic and, I think, very beautiful interior spaces. So what we have at MacArthur Park is, as I said, a 1920s building, quite beautiful, but it needs a whole new purpose in terms of use. The exterior needs to be restored, but part of it is that we have a courtyard, we have facades that can be rethought, and most importantly, the interiors need to be reinvented entirely. And I think that Selgascano have proven, at least from what I've seen, that they're very, very good in terms of aesthetics, but very creative. And talking about ecology, very sensitive to ecology. So lots of green and plants, very natural in spirit. And the idea of inside and outside is something that they've navigated in a way that's, I think, very unique and very creative.
Speaking of sustainability, another dimension of sustainability has come up in relation to this project, which is sustainability of the long-term community. There's two businesses that are in that project, Aardvark Letterpress and McManus and Morgan and Paper Company, both very much embedded in LA's art production, I guess. And they're in that building, and now there's some questions about whether they'll be able to stay. And I guess Mr. Selgers, you know, is very emphatic that they should be able to stay and be incorporated into the design. Is that something that might happen?
So we obviously have to balance the needs of the Institute, that's why we are there and moving there, with the historical significance and needs of the tenants that you just talked about. I think they do wonderful work. So we're trying very much to keep them there in a way that works for them, but also for us.
And they've had clients that include Ed Ruscha, some of the LA's great artists. So they have a very strong place in Los Angeles, which begs the question, what attracts you to Los Angeles? Why are you putting these centers here? Could they be somewhere else?
So no question. We could be, I mean, this is a place of choice. I would say there's the answer today, and then there's the personal answer. The personal answer is that I grew up in Paris, then moved to London, then New York. And I just found Los Angeles a place that is incredibly open physically, but also mentally. It has space to think, to invent, and you're not burdened by the past. That can be great. It's also obviously a weakness. You don't have the richness of a place like Paris or London, but you have the entire future in front of you. Not only did the idea of the Institute come out of my time here in Los Angeles, and I started spending time with professors, philosophy and political science professors at UCLA, but I also felt that it was natural, at least in Los Angeles, it would be a good place for an Institute that focuses on ideas to exist, because ideas are about the future and about change. Los Angeles is a place that looks towards the future, I think, and is definitely about change. So very appropriate here.
Will you also engage, therefore, with some of LA's own challenges? For example, right now, there's actually a real struggle over growth. There's a large, large contingent of the LA population that wants to move forward, just as you've said. There's also pushback from others that want LA to slow down, stop growing, retrench somewhat. There's also a massive challenge around affordability of housing, partly because of this exact struggle. Is that the kind of thing that you will engage with, and will you get in the trenches with?
So the Institute is really about ideas and about hopefully solutions, but in the very long term. There aren't many institutes or places that do this around the world. So we don't want to compromise what our mission is. I don't think our mission is to reinvent LA itself. We'll let LA reinvent itself around us. In terms of your remarks, I think they're very relevant. So if we can help, we will, but that's not our main mission. But there's no question that there is a struggle between, you know, growth and let's call it no growth or preservation. There's a struggle between the two. I frankly think a city dies if it doesn't accept change and growth. And I also think that for housing affordability, if you stop growth, housing becomes more expensive, not less. So again, I think that to provide housing and to provide more affordable housing, you have to let it be built. So you have to encourage, and you cannot be too restrictive. So cities that allow change are the most interesting and the most dynamic cities, and long-term will make urban dwellers happiest.
And lastly, you have a Spanish architect at MacArthur Park. You have Swiss Herzog de Meuron on the hill. You have, I think, a French landscape designer, very much a European sensibility. Did you consider any local architects as you were going through the process of making these choices?
We did. And if we did something in the future, we'll do again. So we didn't look at nationality, at race. We talked about architects, many of them, from Asia, from South America, Africa. So we talked to architects who were around the world. And most of these architects I'd love to do a project with. So it was actually difficult to make the choices that we did because there were so many other good architects and so many other good proposals. So if I had a dream, I'd love to do 30 projects because it would be 30 exciting, beautiful buildings with great architects. So our choice ended up being what we felt was appropriate for the building and the site this time around. In the future, who knows?
That was Nicholas Bergwijn. I'm Frances Anderton. This is DNA. After this break, artists from Mexico, Cuba, and Brazil take on the conflicted legacy of modernist architecture.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
With DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. 6 years ago, more than 60 organizations presented exhibitions and programs that told the story of the rise of the LA art scene. It was sponsored by the Getty and called Pacific Standard Time. Then followed another citywide art effort focused on modern architecture in LA. Now it's time for Pacific Standard Time, LA LA. That's a celebration of Latin American and Latino art that runs through the end of next January. The official kickoff takes place in Grand Park on Thursday, September 14th, but some shows have already opened and a bunch will open this coming weekend. Over the coming weeks, we're going to tell you about some of the exhibitions that focus in very different ways on architecture and design. Let's start at Barnsdall Art Park and learn about an exhibition curated by Clara Kim.
It's called Condemned to be Modern, which comes from a quote by the Brazilian critic Mario Pedrosa, who infamously wrote about Brasilia shortly after it was constructed and claimed that Brazil was condemned to be modern. So it was inspired by that.
Brasilia designed by the architect Oscar Niemeyer.
Yes, exactly.
It's quite a provocative statement, condemned to be modern. What does it mean as it relates to your show?
Well, for me, it relates to the fate of architecture, I suppose, and a questioning of architecture. The exhibition consists of 21 contemporary artists responding critically to various moments in architecture in Brazil, Mexico, and Cuba. And so the exhibition is not a traditional architecture show, but they're contemporary artist projects who are responding to what we've been calling kind of the afterlives of modernist projects. So it's really about artists responding critically to it, imagining different scenarios, questioning the kind of rhetoric and promise of many of these modernist projects that came about in the 1950s and 60s in these various places as a moment to redefine kind of who they are as a nation, wrapped up in kind of political rhetoric, and of course an ambition to claim its place in the world. You'll see that in the individual artist projects, but some of them take a more kind of imaginative approach. For instance, Eduardo Abaroa's project imagines the destruction of the Anthropology Museum in Mexico City, which is of course a very sacred place for pre-Columbian cultures. And for him, it's a commentary on political policies as it relates to indigenous cultures. But his project involves kind of the systematic destruction of the museum itself and really the kind of symbol of architecture of these cultures being more important than the lives, the everyday lives of people. And I think many artists approach it in that way, that kind of human dimension of these built projects. Clarissa Tossin, who did a new work responding to the Hollyhock House, she actually grew up in Brasilia. And her projects, you know, have to do with that, the kind of everyday element of cleaning, you know, the Herculean task of cleaning the white marble every day in some of the buildings in Brasilia, or the footpaths that people make as shortcuts through the monumental axis of Brasilia. So it's that kind of everyday human lived dimension of architecture, which I think really is the kind of root of the show.
Clara Kim walks us past photos of Brasilia by the artist Mario Resti that depict the city in less monumental ways than typical architectural photography. And she introduces us to Beto Schifati. He is based in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and his piece is called Remediations. You see a wooden screen that serves as a partition. On the wall are framed photos and magazine ads that are paired in such a way that critique the idea of progress in Brazilian society. For example, you see a picture of Brasilia just after it was built, paired with an advertisement from the National Association of Advertisers of Brazil praising the country's former military president. Like many of the exhibits in this show, his piece is conceptual, and it's good that he's there to explain all the elements.
Well, the screen functions as a kind of interface, let's say, between a certain space that is a standpoint where you are like from outside trying to look inside, let's say. They are called in Brazil treliças. This comes from the colonial times. It's an influence from Portuguese architecture that is also influenced by North African architecture, like the Muslims, let's say, or the North Africans. And it was used mainly in Brazil to allow someone that is inside of the house to observe what is going on outside without being seen.
Through the screen, you can see chairs of different styles and sizes. They represent the classes in Brazilian society. And there's an old-style TV on a stand made of cement blocks.
That makes an evocation also to this ongoing attempt of constructing reality with our own hands. In Brazil, more than 50% of the constructed buildings are self-constructed. Like, we have like a huge, and it's still growing, you know, a huge number of self-constructed communities. Some people call them favelas, but this is probably, if we can talk about the Brazilian style, I would say that is not Niemeyer, our greatest architect, but it's the people, like they do like miracles sometimes with these materials that are really humble.
That was the Brazilian artist Beto Schifati. His work is part of the show Condemned to be Modern. It opens September 10th at the LA Municipal Art Gallery at Barnsdall Park. It's part of Pacific Standard Time, LA. I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. Ray Guana mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman. And thank you very much for listening.